Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Project MedTech. I am your host, Dwayne Mancini. As always, if you have any suggestions for future guests or want to get a hold of the podcast, please feel free to email us at projectmedtechpodcast@gmail.com. My guest today is Dr. Nikhil Shah. Dr. Nikhil currently serves as the System Director for Minimally Invasive Digital and Robotic Surgery at Pedimont Healthcare, based in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Shah has performed thousands of minimal access and robotic procedures. He is also currently the CEO and co-founder of Nephrodite Incorporated, an early-stage startup medical device company focused on developing an implantable, continuous, functioning dialysis device. In this episode of the podcast, we discuss Nephrodite, other ventures including digital surgery, implantable bladder, and e-health initiatives, advice for startup companies, and plenty more. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy my discussion with Dr. Nikhil Shah.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech.
Okay, Nikhil, thanks for joining me on the podcast this evening.
Happy to be here, Dwayne. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, you know, you're the CEO and co-founder of Nephrodite. You know, let's hold off on that real quick. I want to talk a little bit about your background, but that's your current position, right? But you're a doctor as well. So maybe talk a little bit about your background as a medical doctor and kind of go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I am a surgeon by training, so with a specialty in genitourinary medicine, so a urologist.
Okay.
And I subspecialized in two different areas. One was oncology, so cancers of the bladder, the ureter that connects the kidney and the bladder, the kidneys as well, prostate, and things like that. So so that's the bulk, if not all, of my practice. I also have some leadership roles that I've served in several hospitals in the executive, and an educator. I consider myself somewhat of an educator. I'm an adjunct professor at Georgia Tech, and I teach medical students, and I actually travel globally to teach surgeons how to operate.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. And where's Georgia Tech located down in Georgia?
It is in Midtown Atlanta.
Right? Okay. Oh, great. So right in the middle there. Okay, cool. You know, I'm not going to hold it against you that you did, what is it, your undergrad at University of Michigan and fellowship?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's a respectable school. Just don't like the football team. cool. So, and you're still practicing today then?
I am, although I will say this, I'm board certified and I have privileges to operate and see patients, but I don't. So I'm clinically currently inactive on a sabbatical of sorts. Mm-hmm. So I'm running Nephrodite full time. I'm also on select occasions I'm traveling and teaching to take advantage of I guess keeping my feet warm, if you will, and in the clinical arena.
Cool. All right. Well, so let's talk about Nephrodite. I wanted to give the audience a little bit of background on to who you are, you know, how you got here. But let's talk about Nephrodite, what you're doing, where you're at, that kind of thing.
Thanks. So, my co-founder, Hip Nguyen, he goes by Bob. He's a pediatric urologist, and we have together taken care of a lot of patients with kidney failure. Their kidneys for a variety of reasons have stopped working, or they were removed because of cancer, but they find themselves without the ability to clear toxins. We have two filters in our body that clear toxins. One is our paired organs, the kidneys, and the other is the liver. Okay. And when your kidneys stop working, that is incompatible with life. And so the only option available to patients is to undergo dialysis. And the meaning of dialysis is literally to filter and cleanse the blood. Dialysis was was pioneered in 1943. And I guess it's interesting, but not to us as we've learned more about the space, but dialysis hasn't seen any innovation to any appreciable degree since 1943. And it was that concept that surrounded the epicenter, if you will, it was the epicenter of the crux of the problems that both Bob and I saw our patients experiencing by having dialysis. And the current form of dialysis is intermittent, meaning you only get your blood filtered and cleansed about three times a week. And that's in contrast to our kidneys that are working 24/7. And so as a result of the only getting intermittent dialysis, patients sort of feel really good when they get dialysis. And then over the next day and a half, they start to develop those toxins and they feel really bad. And those constant peaks and troughs or ebbs and flows are what make not patients not only feel miserable, but they feel miserable as a reflection of what's going on inside their bodies. It is literally wreaking havoc inside their bodies. So that was the genesis of Bob and I sort of saying, we've got to do something different than what's been going on for the last 80 years.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. So I, you know, that sounds like it's a good history. It's a good mission, right? Where'd the name come from?
So there's a bigger story behind how we sort of thought of the device, but as mm-hmm. we had conceived the device, we were sitting with a bunch of engineers and scientists all the way in Munich, Germany. And one of the scientists said, you know, I really, really love what you're doing. You know, I really love this idea. And it so happened that his fiance, who was also a scientist at German Aerospace, made a comment like, I thought you loved me, you know, sort of yeah. tongue in cheek. And he said, oh, and he made some sort of comment like, I need to get bitten again by the goddess of love, Aphrodite. And about a few seconds later, we sort of realized we should come up with a company name. And it was sort of tongue in cheek at the time. And someone said, well, what should we call the name? And Bob looks at me and says, well, what would the goddess of kidneys be? And I said, probably Nephrodite. That's how we came up with the name. And it stuck.
Yeah. I'm assuming that's a play on like, what is it, nephrons or something like this? Yeah. Yeah. That's good. So, you know, let's maybe talk about the device. You know, I don't know what you can share and what you can't sure. and whatnot, but maybe go into some detail there about what it is and how you're solving the need for innovation in a space that desperately needs it.
Yeah, absolutely. So what Bob and I wanted to address in our device as we started thinking about it was, so the first point to make is Bob and I were visiting professors at German Aerospace, and during a tour, they had shown us a concept, but a real prototype concept of an implantable heart. Mm-hmm. And that implantable heart, it was literally amazing. And you know, both of he and I joke, I mean, what else would you expect from German engineering, right? I mean, yeah. it was really great.
Right.
And as we started looking at it, Bob kind of looked at me and said, wow, it's so fascinating. Imagine if we were to miniaturize this heart. And then I looked back at him and said, well, yeah, maybe use it as a dialysis device. And so we sort of instantly, and by the way, we had never met before. We had sort of first met at that time. Okay. He was in Harvard at Boston Children's, and I was in Ann Arbor or something like that. So so we sort of sat down and started talking about things. And the first thing we sort of said was, well, if we make a miniaturized pump, if you will, like a mechanical dialysis pump. And again, dialysis means to filter. He said, well, what are the attributes that we would need? And so we started going over that. We'd need a housing, we need some membranes in order to allow the blood to be cleared through the membranes. The concept of our kidneys, there's two purposes. One is to filter and one is to exchange fluid. And that's why our kidneys, when it filters the blood, which is about 20% of our blood volume every minute. When it filters our blood, there's a byproduct of that blood, which is water from the filtration process. And that is excreted in the form of urine, because it goes down to our bladders and excreted. So you can't really think about a new or novel dialysis device unless you address both the filtering and the fluid exchange. So he said, we've got to figure out a way to filter it, because he said, what's going on right now is patients have grafts put in their arms. And I think you've seen patients with arm grafts. It's really, it's blown up. The blood vessels are kind of, you know, really big and monstrous. And what they do at dialysis, they put a needle in that graft and they use that graft in their arm. It's called a fistula. They use that to use for dialysis over about 3 or 4 hours. So Bob said, there's absolutely right. There's a right way and a wrong way, and accessing the blood supply, the vascular space, is the right way to go. It's very efficient. It makes sense. Our kidneys are connected to our blood supply. So he said, our device has to be connected to our blood supply. And he said, but there's another form of dialysis called peritoneal or abdominal dialysis. And that is really inefficient. And there's a lot of complications along with that. And Bob said, we've got to be able to filter the fluid, but not do it in the abdomen. We got to stay away from the abdomen. So he said, why don't we put the device in the pelvis, hook it up to one of the arteries in the pelvis, but then have an exchange of fluid happen outside of the body with the tube coming out, where we could exchange bags of fluid to allow for an exchange. So the fluid's coming in and the blood circulating, and the fluid and the blood are exchanging toxins for nutrients. And so what's staying in the blood is good, and what's going out into the bag is bad. And so we have a combination of an implantable dialysis device that's always 24/7 implanted. You can't access it once it's been surgically put in, but we have a port connected to a bag that a patient would wear on a vest, and that bag would hold fluid that connects to the device inside, and that would allow for the exchange of fluid. So it's kind of like a hybrid wearable. Mm-hmm. Even implantable. So we kind of have like two parts to our device.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting. I hope that made sense.
Yeah. So you're not, when you know, when you're having this process, you're mobile. I mean, is that.
That's right. So, you know, a big complaint that we hear from a lot of patients is, so there's a lot of issues with intermittent dialysis. You have to do it at a center.
Yeah.
You have to be lucky enough to have someone to drive you to a center. So imagine you're really elderly, you don't have kids, or kids are far away, spouse has passed away or not around. How do you get to the dialysis center? It's not that easy. Or it's just a burden on your loved ones. But you got to get to the center. When you get to the center, it's typically the dialysis itself is 3 or 4 hours. So if you include all the logistics, right? You got to get in the car, you got to drive to the center, then you got to get home. I mean, that could be a half a day process for a lot of people.
Sure.
When you're there, you can't move. You're sitting in a chair, your arm's out, you can't really move it, you can't really go anywhere. And so 3 days a week, you're tied to a chair, can't really do anything. There are some new concepts coming out where they're talking about bringing the dialysis machine from the center to the home. And we get that. We don't think that that's going to be real disruptive. And the reason is that because there are limitations to how much you can do dialysis at home, because you're not going to have a full-time technician monitoring you. The amount of time you can dialyze, because there's going to be certain stop gaps for safety reasons, it's probably 8 hours of dialysis that you're going to have to do at home to be, because you can't do as much. So I think patients are going to, you know, you're either going to be stuck at the center or you're going to be stuck at home. Our device, which is going to be surgically implanted, allows the patients to be completely mobile.
They can
go to the store. They can go to the movies. They can go to relative's house, neighbor's house. They're going to
Yeah, that's really impressive. I mean, it's really cool. And so to be clear, just for everyone listening, you know, what stage are you at in terms of the company wise? I mean, and I think the major disclaimer I want to make here, that we can go into more detail, is this is not an FDA approved device yet, correct?
No. And I would even take it a step further for you in the audience, not even close.
Yeah, right. So, and we're going to talk a little bit about that, because this is the fun stuff, right? At least for me. So you are at prototype phase, or
we have a prototype of what the big novelty is, which is the actual miniaturized mechanical dialysis pump.
Yes. Okay. Very good. And how long has Nephrodite been around? When was the company founded?
2014.
Okay. Very good. Cool. So yeah, I mean, this is really interesting. I mean, anytime you talk about a product that, like I think in the interventional radiology space, it was always, can you reduce time that someone has to stay in the hospital? Can you reduce the number of times a patient has to have surgery? You know, and like this one, it's, can you reduce the amount of trips to a center? You know, can you give someone their independence back a little bit? It's huge. I mean, those are the disruptive technologies. It kind of stems right in with what we're seeing in the industry now with telehealth and with digital health and with, you know, a lot of those different things. So I think that's really cool.
It is. I would add the following though, Duane, which is the one of the equally big issues, if you will, for dialysis is the access. Mm-hmm. So what happens in a majority of patients is that we take their arm and we create in their lower arm or their forearm, we create the shunt or the graft for which they go through dialysis. And that's a surgical procedure with a vascular surgeon usually. And the problem is that because that graft is constantly being poked or accessed during dialysis, it's prone to clotting and it's prone to infection, which invariably happens within some period of time of that happening. And when that graft fails, then we go on the upper arm and we create another graft. And we use that one till that fails. And then we go to the other arm and we keep going until we've gone through both arms. And pretty much by the time you've gone through both arms, you've lost all your access.
Yeah.
And so patients are unable to dialyze. It's also painful. It's also uncomfortable. When we use the abdomen, we actually instill water into the abdomen and we allow the dialysis occur through the abdomen, not a blood vessel. And that's very uncomfortable. That can be done at home, but it's very uncomfortable. And so a majority of patients, if not all the patients, say, I don't want to go through the access procedures and I don't want to go through all of that trouble. It's so bad. Our device is going to be connected directly to a larger artery in the lower abdomen pelvis. And it's going to stay there and it's going to continuously filter. So we don't have to keep going back. We don't have to poke it. The other question I get asked a lot is, but wouldn't it be prone to infection? It won't be, because we're never going to keep poking that. It's surgically implanted and it will never be touched.
That's great. So I want to talk about, well, I think I'm going to save that for the end because I want to talk about you know, some of the needs or some of the support that you might be looking for. And maybe we could tap into some of the people who are listening, whether they be, you know, regulatory, reimbursement, clinical experts that can maybe lend some advice because they've had these kind of products before, have worked on similar spaces. But let's talk a little bit about some of the other ventures you have going on as well. Some of the other initiatives. You want to talk a little bit about that as well?
Along with Nephrodite, like as a part of Nephrodite, or you mean separate from Nephrodite?
Yeah, separate from Nephrodite. Yeah.
So we have quite a few. So so Bob and I have been working on an implantable bladder, a urinary. Okay.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, a lot of people lose their bladders for a variety of different reasons. Bob takes care of a lot of patients with spina bifida, cerebral palsy, all whom have neurologic disorders, things like that, all who have issues with their bladder. Okay. And when your bladder stops working, it's actually, you know, I mean, not to sound trite, but it's a big deal. And we don't have, like, we can do a heart transplant or heart replacement. We can do things like that. We don't have a bladder replacement. So we've got that project. I mean, it's going well, but you know, we don't want to do too many things at once. We're concentrating.
Sure.
Nephrodite, not bladderdite yet.
Yeah.
I'm really passionate about men's health. So I have a not-for-profit where we explore why are men stoic with their health and why are they reactive instead of proactive as compared to our female counterparts. And I know I'm not trying to offend anyone by sort of making it a gender issue, but it really is a gender issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least if we look at older generations, and we tend, at least, and those are the people I take care of, there tends to be profound differences. Females tend to be the consumers of healthcare in a household. They tend to be very proactive with their health, and men tend to be very reactive. They wait until they have an event, and then they go to the doctor. And sometimes, many times, it's too late.
Yeah. And what's that not-for-profit called?
The Men's Health and Wellness Center. It's pretty easy.
Okay. That's cool. All right. Very good. Yeah, that's actually really interesting. I think that goes along pretty well with what we're seeing, moving into like for instance, like I wear this band here, it's called a Whoop band, and it tracks your heart rate variability. And it's a nice device, it kind of takes maybe like what the Apple Watch can do to like the next level. So I can monitor strain on my body and that sort of thing. But you're 100% right. Like when I was going through college, my master's and my first, 3 years when I moved to Cleveland, I didn't have a primary care doctor. I didn't go to the doctor. I didn't go do my blood work. Now I'm like, I'm like, what am I doing? I got to go get my blood work done. And I know, blood work's kind of funny because it's like a snapshot in time. So, it gives you a good picture, but might not be like end all be all. But at the very least, I go every 6 months for that just because like I want to know. Hopefully that changes a little bit and people.
Yeah. One interesting concept. We've come up with two interesting concepts in the sort of the specifically the men's health space. One is if you really want to get to, the male patient, mm-hmm. you have to go after his partner, because that partner, irrespective of gender, but that partner is going to be the decision maker of care.
Yeah.
In that couple. Yeah. And in that family. And so we are trying to think of ways, marketing and things like that to really go after the couple.
Yeah.
The second thing we know about men, and it's a generalization, I totally get it, but men are tend to be, even if there's if there's alphas and betas and whatever, they tend to be really competitive. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. I have a cousin in Chicago, not too far from you. And we were driving down the road one day and we literally almost got into an accident because he was on his phone, but he had to tell his app, right, that there was a car on the side of the road. He's a Wazer, right?
Sure.
Yep. So but he went out of his way, and it was horrible traffic, and he had to click the button and say there was a hazard, and it was like, what are you doing? And he said, well, I had to get points. I said, you get points, so we get killed but you get points? He said, no, I get points, and every time I identify a police officer or a hazard, something like that, I get points. And I said, what do you get for those points? He said, well, I'm pretty close to being a King Wazer. I said, wow. I mean, do you get 50% off Dairy Queen? What do you get for that? He goes, oh, you don't get anything.
Yeah.
I just get to be King Wazer. The point being is that when you gamify things, right? Just like the, right. I mean, how many people you see like around with their watches and their devices like you?
Yep.
You've got to do their 10,000 steps or 15,000 steps.
Right.
It's become sort of a game for them. So we're trying to explore ways we could gamify your health in order to spur interest in that population.
Yeah, it's a really good idea. I was just going to say, so before I got my Whoop band, I compete against one of my good friends who lives in Toledo, and we compete in recovery, sleep, and total strain throughout a day. But before that, when I had my Apple Watch, there was me and probably five or six of my friends who all competed against each other, and you can send each other like reminders that, oh, I just ran 3 miles, but Nicole just did 6, and there was like this competition back and forth. So yeah, it totally makes sense. you know, some other topics I want to circle back to some advice for a startup company, maybe not so much advice, but some things you learned, you know, or that you are currently learning through your current, you know, company. But before we get there, you know, some of their topics, you know, I sent you like a little pre, interview thing that I do with all my guests, and some of their topics you mentioned you're passionate about were, minimally invasive surgeries. And you kind of talked about, or you kind of had robotics, digital surgery, and image-based surgery. Now for a layman, you know, maybe break that down. What is that? And talk about that, because I know robotics is big. I mean, every major orthopedic player has a robotic surgery device, but it hasn't exactly caught fire yet. So I'd like to hear it from your perspective as well. I mean, you're a surgeon.
Yeah. So there are different types of robots, surgical robots in different spaces. The one that has really, I would say, has really disrupted the market in terms of traditional open surgery where we make incisions, is a soft tissue robot. It's made by a company called Intuitive Surgical. The name of that robot's the Da Vinci. There are some other companies coming out now, but for the better part of 20 years, they received FDA approval in 1999. So they've been around really since about 99, 2000. So for the past 20 years, they've really been, for soft tissue surgery in the chest, abdomen, or pelvis, they've been the player. It's been a virtual monopoly. But they make an exquisite machine. And why is that? Well, the genesis of the machine came not from a company, but came from world-class scientists from NASA and the Department of Defense, a special project agency called DARPA. Mm-hmm. And the history of that, it stems from a astronaut who became very sick in space during a mission, and one of their appendix burst. And they couldn't treat him, obviously, in space. They couldn't abandon the mission. Luckily, he survived. But when he came back down, that spurred a bunch of conversation about how could we potentially treat our astronauts in space, or take it another step, our injured soldiers on the battlefield.
Right.
You don't want to send a medic or a corpsman or somebody out there and then have them get injured. Now you've got, you know, more injured people. So the concept of sending out or doing teleremote surgery in space or the battlefield came about. And so that was the initial prototype was the product of very smart scientists from the Stanford Research Labs and from these agencies. So that amounted to, that then came to be the Da Vinci surgical robot made by Intuitive Surgical. And that is the robot that most of us currently use today. We're going to see probably a transition over time very soon where, and it's a robot that we use in the operating room, but there's no autonomy. It is just a teleremote system. So the surgeon is in the corner of the operating room, the patient is in the center of the room, and there's a robotic system that has instruments that go inside the patient through very small holes. And the surgeon is controlling the tools. Mm-hmm. So it's not like an autopilot on a plane. It's like a pilot actually piloting the plane.
Right.
But I think we're going to get to a point where that autopilot is going to happen. And so as we start introducing, imaging like x-rays, meaning CAT scans, MRIs, into the operating room, where that becomes our eyes, instead of cutting people open and looking in, we're going to be able to see things through intraoperative x-rays, intraoperative imaging, and then we're going to be able to access it without having to cut people open, but with just targeting it, kind of like a drone, right? The drones are out there, they're operated teleremotely by the Air Force pilot on the ground, hundreds of thousands of miles away, and they can launch, right? They can launch missiles from that and directly target the bad guys through guidance and navigation. And I think that's not too unrealistic in medicine in the next 10 years.
Wow. Yeah, okay. I mean, this is why, you know, so I see a lot of companies on a day-to-day basis, but in a general term, rarely get insight like this into, you know, where the industry is going. To talk about the robotic system a little bit. So have you used these then?
So I am what one would call an early adopter. I was part of the pioneering team in Detroit. Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, I know there's a famous video on YouTube. It's one that I used to show high school students when I would go in and talk about a career in medical devices. And I show it of them, of the Da Vinci system peeling a grape, you know, layer by layer. And it's crazy. Right. The only bad press that I've personally seen on the Da Vinci was, it was a documentary on Netflix called The Bleeding Edge. Are you familiar with this at all? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think in that one, it was pretty much maybe how it was rolled out, and there was the lack of training on the Da Vinci system. I assume that's not a problem anymore. And it seems like that would have been fixed after that. You know, like what amount of hours are required? How much training is required? Because this isn't, I guess, you know, like typical, it's new, right? You got to train on this. It's not just using your hands, right? I mean, so is there a lot of training for these systems now? Is that an issue you see moving forward, you know, getting surgeons up to speed on this kind of technology, or do you think it's getting easier?
It's a tough question. So, I'm going to make some provocative statements, and I'll probably be held to task. And that's okay, because I'm really passionate about this topic.
Yep.
So I fully agree that you can rarely blame the tool. Mm-hmm. Training is required. The skill set required to do tele-remote surgery with a robot, where it involves using 3D magnification for vision and operating instruments far away from the patient, is an entirely different skill set than what we learn in training.
Yeah.
And so I know a lot of patients assume, well, you're a trained surgeon, therefore the training, you must be trained on the robot, or you probably been trained pretty easily on the robot. And the short answer is that's completely false. Number one. Number two, as a medical profession, we have kind of failed in this regard, because we have not captured the training and standardized it across the profession and across specialties. So multiple specialties, 8 to 9 different subspecialties of surgery, whether it's heart, lungs, urology, colorectal, general surgery, you name the specialty in surgery, they're all able to use the robot. And this particular one, I'm not really talking about orthopedics, which has its own
set of things. Yep.
And the problem is that everybody has a different learning curve, and we haven't standardized the training to different sets of capabilities and different sets of learning. And the problem is we haven't done a good job of isolating who needs more training and who doesn't. The process is flawed in so many ways. And so when surgeons start to operate with a robot, which begins very quickly, the actual training process is disjointed. It doesn't happen very well, but it happens through, you know, attending a series of just sort of courses and classes, either online and some labs, but then you get a certificate and you get it very liberally. And then you take that certificate to your hospital, and then you're supposed to do a series of mentored or proctored cases. That means another surgeon will watch you do the surgery and sign off on it. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that the amount of scrutiny that goes into watching a colleague do that surgery is not robust. And so when everyone is aligned in that room towards an end goal of volume, right? Volume, more volume sells more instruments for the company and more robots for the company, and more volume means more throughput for the hospital. Everyone's aligned towards that surgery continuing and that surgeon continuing to do more cases. And so what's happened over time is it's just sort of been an understanding that you're going to start doing robotic surgery on patients. But, and as you get better and better and better, you'll get better and better and better. The problem is, you're doing that on a person, on a real mm-hmm. being who may or may not, we don't really have any transparency to say, I just want you to know you're my third case. And, right. And if you do, you can sort of minimize it, because I don't think patients really understand what that means. But I'm trained, but you're my third case. Oh, no problem, doc. I trust you. Right. So I just think we have to do a better job. Now, what did the pilots do? We could look at what the pilots did. The pilots began sim training. So not only did they do classroom training and they observed and they went through the didactics, they then sit in a sim for hundreds of hours.
Yeah.
And they practice on almost sort of real life conditions. And that sim goes on and on and on, so that by the time they sit in that cockpit, it is not very new. They understand from flying from point A to B and all the steps in between. We haven't gotten there. What would be great, if anybody's listening and wants to truly build it, is to build an actual simulator in surgery that starts from the beginning of surgery to the end of surgery. I'll say one more point. The training that's done right now, there are sims out there, but the sims are mostly task-based, meaning do this task and then you're done. If you and I were to get in a car right now, I drive a Chevy Tahoe. We get in the car and we're sitting in my garage and we turn the car on. And Dwayne, you say, I want you to put the indicator light, the right one on. And I want you to hit the brake. And I want you to turn the wheel while we're in park. I can do those tasks. But Dwayne, if you then say to me, you and I are going from Atlanta to Toledo, that's a whole different game. Because there's stoplights, there's stop signs, there's people crossing the street, there's rodents crossing the street. There's all sorts of scenarios. You can't just do tasks and then go on to do the whole thing. So we have to graduate from that and we have to do better.
Yeah. You know, this makes a lot of sense. I mean, this is a perspective that I usually don't get, right? So, you know, I'm so hyper-focused on helping companies get from point A to point B. And point A is, you know, their company, like the inception of their company, and point B is not just regulatory approval, but market access, right? It's very little where we think about it, but at the same time, it's not like an immediate goal of, okay, you know, what needs to change in the actual system for this to be effective,
right?
You know, and this is a good point. I mean, there's a lot of training that's going to go behind some of this new technology. It's just what's going to have to happen. But it's good to know that people are at least, I guess, thinking about it, like yourself. You have anything else to say on that point?
No, I mean, yes, but I won't.
No, it's not boring. It's absolutely fascinating. Let's talk a little bit about, and maybe you can make a delineation between the three, but like value-based care, and that could probably dovetail into improving the patient journey and transparency in the healthcare system. I feel like there's an easy way to connect those three things probably. So I don't know. We could start at the top though, value-based care. Maybe explain it. I'm not sure I actually even really understand that fully.
Well, so actually, and I'll a shout out to Vivian Lee. She's just written a book about, okay. She is one of the leaders at Verily Life Sciences, which is a Google company. Vivian just wrote a book on how to fix the healthcare system. And the greater points that, you know, she and others have made is that the U.S. healthcare system is based on a fee for service system. And so, you know, and that's irrespective of, yeah, insurance companies may not pay everything that's charged, but we get paid on every procedure and every test that we order. And so if you can imagine, the result of that, that does often amount to times where you know, tests are ordered liberally and maybe procedures are done. And I'm not trying to insinuate that, you know, that there's a malintent here or anything like that. But we have not developed a system that necessarily takes into account the cost when the costs are being reimbursed every time. And so in a value-based healthcare system, there would be metrics through which analytics could be performed and the value that is offered towards the patient experience in every way, shape, or form would be valued, and that would be reimbursed. And that's complicated, right? How do you assign value? What is that value? There's a whole, you know, a whole bunch of things around that. But this isn't really a new concept in healthcare, and it is being done in other places in the world. And you know, the U.S. healthcare system is composed of amazingly great physicians and providers and nurses and therapists and the whole nine yards, and yet we are one of the most expensive healthcare systems in the world, and our outcomes in many things like infant mortality and mortality of mothers giving birth is lower than a lot of other nations in the world. And so how can we have the best healthcare system when the metrics and the outcomes that are used don't reflect that, and we're the most expensive? So, and we've seen costs rise, but we haven't seen the outcomes. So if costs were rising, but outcomes were getting better, one could argue a justification for the costs. We've not seen that yet. So a value-based healthcare system is trying to say, look, you have arthritis of your hip and you need a hip replacement. The total journey of that patient of getting x-rays, seeing the doctor, the orthopedic surgeon, getting scheduled for surgery, and then going to rehab, that entire continuum of care, the patient care continuum, if you will, would have a value on it rather than, and that's how the system reimburses the care team and the hospitals and the physicians and the nurses, as opposed to, we're going to order 5 tests, we're going to do surgery, we're going to order a bunch more tests, and then a bunch more tests, because at every point in that care cycle, there's a reimbursement happening rather than being mindful of those tests. So the transparency that I speak to is a little bit more about also the example I give some of my students is the following. The Falcons here in Atlanta are not faring well this season. And it's got to be exceedingly painful for and I hate to pick on Matt Ryan, but you know, Matt Ryan threw a pick six, he got sacked, whatever but he is reminded of that painfully so the next morning, right?
Right.
Everyone's talking about it, he's got to see it, but he takes it and he understands it and he probably watches film and he's got to talk about it and he gets better. In surgery and in medicine, we don't really have that transparency. We don't use transparent metrics and analytics to say to docs, look, here are all the surgeons doing hernia surgery in this hospital. Here's how long it took to do the hernia. Here's their cost associated with doing a hernia. Why is this surgeon using, you know, mesh that's 3 times more expensive than this surgeon? And what are her outcomes, right? And so I think as we introduce those metrics and a profound amount of data in a way that is constructive and productive, and we're transparent with it, meaning there's going to be a lot of tough conversations. And a lot of my colleagues don't like me for saying this, but we're too quiet about it. We should be held to the same standard Matt Ryan is. And as painful as it is to hear, we should know that we can be more efficient. And I'm not talking about quality of surgery necessarily. I'm talking about efficiencies throughout the whole process. I hear a lot of my colleagues say, yeah, that's a great idea, but the minute that happens, I'm going to get sued. And there's no question that tort reform is necessary, or at least needs to be addressed in the conversation. But I think from cost, addressing cost along with quality and efficiencies, and I'm not trying to just use buzzwords, but we can do that if we're more transparent about the way we do business.
Yeah, you're not the first guest to say that. I actually was reminded of that as I've been listening to you. I had Arlen Myers on. I don't know if you know who that is. He runs the Society of Physician Entrepreneurs. It's abbreviated SOAP. And he's a physician himself, and I forget what his specialty is. And, but, I had him on the podcast and he blasted the healthcare system. He called it sick care, and that's all he would address it as. He wouldn't call it healthcare. He'd only call it sick care. Which, you know, I'm not going to argue with them. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. But the one thing he said was, and I think this maybe has to do a little bit with the transparency, is he said I don't want to, what's the proper term here? Because, you know, doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners, PAs in general.
Providers.
Yeah. Healthcare providers. Or in Arlen's case, sick care providers. You know, he made a point that said they rarely ever know what they're ordering and what they're doing is going to cost the patient.
Right.
And he said, that's a problem. You know, you talk about patient empowerment. It's the opposite of that right now. Because they don't know.
And I'll take it from the provider side again. You know, on the leadership side at hospitals, we want our physicians to be better stewards, right? We want them to kind of cut costs, for example, in the operating room or the procedure suite. And we'll sort of say to them, you know, we want you to standardize and this, that, and the other. What we're really trying to tell them is we want to cut costs. But, and so they'll come back and they'll look at us and they'll say, well, how can we cut costs if we don't know what the costs are? Oh, we can't share that with you, that sort of institutional proprietary information. And you could share that with someone else. And then, you know, we'd have to kill you and things like that. So we're not going to share that with you. But you can't be a good steward of the system
if
you don't know, right? And so one of my surgeons who is a hepatobiliary surgeon gave the example of, you know, when I go to Home Depot, and we use that example in Atlanta a lot, right? If I go to Home Depot, I know that that hammer is $3, that one is $12, that one's titanium, it's $37, but I can make the choice if I want to buy the $3 or the $37. I will make a better choice as a physician, surgeon, steward of the health system if you allow me to know the different prices of things in order to make those decisions. And so we actually did a little experiment where we allowed them to know the pricing and we kept it kind of internal as much as we could. And there was no question that after we reviewed everything, that they were absolutely good stewards. They were critical of it.
Yeah. That's really good. That's really good to see and hear. And hopefully that, you know, changes or makes, you know, a big change, in the system. All right. So let's, I want to circle back to the, you know, advice for startup companies. I usually ask this of all my guests. You know, I have a lot of serial entrepreneurs on, and you certainly, you know, fit that bill. You have a lot of ventures you're in. So maybe talk a little bit about, you know, some advice you might have for companies who are early on, just based on, you know, what you're currently going through. You know, what lessons have you learned? What are things that, you know, you say, hey, if I can go back, I would do that 100 times again. You know, I always like that one too. What are the good things that you did?
Yeah. So I, you know, in general, my approach, especially when I'm sort of teaching students and things like that, and I consider myself sort of a student entrepreneur in the sense of going through, you know, Nefertiti and the Holly device that we're putting through. I mean, it's an implantable class 3 device that needs a PMA. This isn't, I mean, this is the big leagues now. So, you know, but I would say this, and it probably doesn't apply to everyone. I don't like to have the regret conversation. If I could go back, I wish I had done X, Y, Z. For me, I always move forward I try not to move backwards as much as I can tell, but since I don't ever think I'm moving backwards, it's my perception, right? Just like it's your show. So I get to own it any which way I want. But I would say this, it's in any part of being an entrepreneur, it's persistence, it's communicating, and it's that positivity of, you know, sort of moving forward. There hasn't been a time where the hard work hasn't paid off. Whether it's been we've learned something or something good happened. And when we started, I didn't have a lot of knowledge about fundraising. I wasn't really attuned to what, you know, a family office or an institutional investor would ask.
Yeah.
They're so good. They can have a 10 question, you know, list for you, and they will know exactly who you are, where you are, and whether it's, you know, you're worth their time. And that's a lot of seasoning right there. I mean, that's a lot of experience, and being able to converse with those folks takes time, and it takes knowing your device, knowing everything that they're going to ask. And I couldn't have just learned it overnight. I couldn't have just learned it in a book. I couldn't have just learned it going to a class. It was the grit, and the grit is necessary, at least the way it's constructed now, right? In the environment that we're in. So you got to have that grit, and you've got to push forward. You've got to be, I will sit and pitch to a group of people and they'll say, well, you should have done this. You should have done that. I don't understand why you didn't have the regulatory path, your competition, your this, that, and the other. And I said, well, you gave me 2 minutes to pitch. Like, what? And then I'll pitch that. So I'll change it around and pitch again to another group of people, and they'll lambaste me for, you know, having that stuff. And what are you talking about? You only had 2 minutes. Why'd you waste your time on that? It's like going in a circle, right? Yeah. But within all of that is always some pearls that we took forward. We stayed strong. And then the other thing is we always communicated as a team. No matter how late it was, we stayed on schedule. We always communicated. Whether it was good news, bad news, whether someone was grumpy, we always communicated. And that is absolutely critical, because without that communication, things get lost. People in groups will think they've been excluded, and you can't have that. We understand we have a hierarchy of sorts, and I don't mean a hierarchy in terms of power or importance. We have a hierarchy of, this person's the CEO, or this person's whatever, and they're doing a lot of the work. And we all get along, and we understand that. We have different personalities, but we all communicate. And that communication is what keeps us bonded in a very, very severe way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, the team's important. So you talk about raising money. Every investor I've ever talked to says, you know, I've said this, I've recorded a podcast earlier today, and I said the exact same quote. It's from my friend Tim Blair. He was episode 7 or something like this. And he says, investors tell him all the time, they'll take a B horse with an A jockey, right? And it's true. I mean, you know, there are, to your point about going through the grit to raise money, you know, those are things you're going to learn, and those things you have to do, but it's only going to set you up, for future success, whether it be with the same company or the next venture. But there are some people out there, because they've gotten so good at it, and because they're such great leaders, and they build such great companies. Yeah, they go out and they go like this, and 10 investors are there saying, oh yeah, we'll give you money, you know? So,
well, they have credibility too.
Right. They have credibility. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And when it's your first time, it's like, you could listen to all the advice you want, talk to as many people as you want. Like you just said, you're not going to learn it until you go through it. And every investor is different, right? I mean, there's going to be overlap with some, of course, but you can walk into an office one day, and the next day, like you said, they're asking a completely different questions.
But I will, so I'll just, you know, one last comment about that.
Yeah.
I would say that after several goes at it and several pitches, and mm-hmm. and I mean several, like, a lot, what we did was we could really dissect down what were the mutual themes from every potential investor and everybody that we talked to that was willing to talk to us, sort of beyond here's three questions, I don't want to talk to you anymore. But people who actually would talk to us, we could nail down recurring themes. And when we were able to do that, we addressed them immediately. Because those things, when they happen repetitively with the same people, they could be small things, or it could be a slide on a pitch deck, or it could be a strategy. but it was important to isolate and identify and isolate recurring themes from people who do know their stuff and have been doing a long time, and to not ignore those, no matter how painful that might be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's good advice. Great
opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. So I will include a link to your LinkedIn in the show notes. So depending on what application people are listening to it on, they can look up or down an inch and have a direct connection to you. You know, and I can also include other ways to get a hold of you as well. If that's a website, that's an email, whatever it may be. Yeah. So look, Nikhil, I appreciate this. Hold on for 1 second. I'll stop the recording here, but I appreciate your time this evening, and thanks for joining the podcast.
I really had a great time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you have any questions or comments for myself or Nikhil, there's a link to our LinkedIn pages in the show notes, or email the podcast, and I'll make sure to get you in touch with Nikhil. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review, and feel free to visit the webpage www.projectmedtech.com or send us an email at projectmedtechpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks and have a great day.